We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts and subscribe to the premium version of thefederalist.com as well. I am joined today once again and very pleased to be joined once again by the one and only Hadley Arkus. He has a book out called Mere Natural Law, Originalism and the Anchoring Truths of the Constitution. Dr. Arkus, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be back with the comparable Emily. Okay. No one quite like her. Okay.
Well, Hadley also is obviously a professor at Amherst College and the founding director was professor.
My sentence was commuted. I was...
Congratulations on that. He's the founding director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding and does all kinds of work, seminars promoting originalism and the likes of what I'm sure you've written about in this book. I know you've written about it in this book, Mere Natural Law. And let's start with that because originalism is in the title of this book. What is the definition of originalism?
Well, I think... I represent the original originalism before the people who call themselves originalists, because we want to go back to the moral ground of the law that the founders understood. That is, we understand part of the pitch of the book, Mere Natural Law, is it's my dear friend Dan Robinson, late friend, said he wanted as his epitaph on his tombstone, he died without a theory. And he was appealing to the teachings of Thomas Reed, the great philosopher read by James Wilson and John Adams, about those precepts of common sense that the ordinary people have to know before they begin trafficking in theories. So before the ordinary man would begin bantering with David Hume about the meaning of causation, he knew his own act of powers to cause his own acts to happen. So what we're arguing here is that the precepts of common sense are there before, these are the principles of common sense and the principles of right that the founders drew upon, as they said, about framing the Constitution. And those principles of right they understood would be there even if there were no Constitution, much in the way that John Quincy Adams said that right to petition the government, that would be there even if it hadn't been mentioned in the First Amendment. Would be there even if there were no First Amendment. It would be there even if there were no Constitution. So what my group is representing in this argument within the conservative community is for an originalism that does not detach the text of the Constitution from those underlying moral truths. And at a certain point, you must be able to move beyond the text of the Constitution or to understand the purpose behind it all, so that it's strange that some kind of conservative judges think that there's something in their theory or code that prevents them from dealing with a case like transgenderism and not going outside the text of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And what do we mean by sex? And appealing to the objective truth of what is in fact is sex, the objective truth of the telos of sex. This has to matter. We have this odd situation in which judges feel constrained sometimes to appeal to the objective truth of the matter. I mean, 50 years ago, the lawyers from Texas on Roe versus Wade brought in an exquisite brief with the most updated findings of embryology to extract these points for the court, that offspring in the womb had been nothing less than human from its first moments. And it has never been merely a part of the body of the mother. But here we have the Dobbs case this last June, and six conservative judges cannot bring themselves to recognize that point, that we're dealing in abortion with a real human being. And so we have Brett Kavanaugh saying, it's interesting that some pro-lifers argue that the fetus is a human life. Interesting. A point that's been well established, embryology. What is there about conservative jurisprudence that moves judges to think that these truths and these moral judgments that are there before the text are things they can't appeal to in explaining what the case is before them. What is this about?
Right. You quote Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence in the book where he says, many pro-life advocates forcefully argue that a fetus is not
life. Is that interesting? They argue it. So conservative jurisprudence has to begin with the proposition that we know nothing about the nature of the child. We have to adopt a radical falsehood as part of this theory of what conservative jurisprudence is supposed to do.
Well, and that's another interesting question, because the founders were obviously students of natural law, and it's baked into our system of government. How did they approach this question? Do we have evidence of how they approached this question about building on the foundations of natural law?
Well, the things that as Jonathan Gina point out, the founders didn't put in the Constitution everything they knew. And so many things, James Wilson, Oliver Ellsworth didn't want to put anything about ex post facto laws. My God, everybody understood that. There's something wrong with holding people punishable for something that was not wrong when it was not illegal when it was done. My God, if you put that in, and that people think that's the only first principle you know. Now, on the matter, on this matter of abortion, James Wilson put it as clearly as can be. If we have natural rights, when do those rights begin? And the answer was, as soon as we begin to be, which is why he said the natural law, the common law, casts its protection over the child in the womb from the first stirrings in the womb, as soon as we know it is there. So, the founders were able to reason about these things. And of course, what they understood is that the natural law is a law that tells you why you have laws and what is a law. Kant would point out that before you have any positive, you've got to have positive law. You have to make a transition between the principles of natural law and regulations that may bear on the circumstances before you. So we may see signs saying 65 mph, 35 mph on the highway. That's the positive law. But before the positive law was a deeper principle that tells you why you'd be justified in restraining the freedom of people to drive at speeds that put innocent life at hazard. So you say, behind any of these positive laws must be a principle that tells you why you'd be justified in having a law there in the first place.
And in fact, there was a lot of the left was rankled by Justice Alito's decision to build his decision in the Dobbs case from natural law and the stirrings and the quickenings. Go ahead.
He didn't build it from natural law.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because I remember, and we did a podcast after the decision was, the decision came out about what would have been a better decision in that case, and what he could have done differently, what Justice Thomas could have done differently in his concurrence. So looking at, Justice Alito talks about those things, where do you think the dots should have been connected in that opinion?
Well, let's go back to what I told you about those lawyers in Roe versus Wade. They point out that we're dealing with a human being, real human being. In that case, in 1972, 73, the court could have said, well, look, the legislature of Texas has found ample reason to hold that is a small human life resident for a while in its mother's womb, but the laws on homicide have ever been indifferent to the size and age and weight of the victim. Once you understand it's a human being, then it should be covered by the laws on homicide. But we leave to the legislature the delicate task of establishing just how early are the protections? What kinds of protections was it practical for you to offer? Well, the critical point in this case is simply making that move. I mean, Justice Alito put all the material to show that there's no principled ground for denying that standing of that child in the womb as a potential, as a human being. He just wouldn't draw the conclusion. He's leaving to people in the political sphere to draw that conclusion. He handed it off to the political sphere. But the political class, we know, is always too diffident and befuddled and timid about talking about these things. But it's look at how we left it. Even Alito would speak about the unborn child as a potential human being. A potential human being. My God, you look at the brief in Texas again, an embryology. It may be a potential outfielder. It is not a potential human being. It's never been merely a potential human being. Well, let's say you just got that one straight. So what do you put in place? You put in place the ground on which the Congress or a federal judge could argue that these blue states are withdrawing the protections of law from a whole class of human beings. They're these small human beings that have to be resident for a while in their mother's wombs. And therefore, you know, we have to overturn or check these laws in the blue states that are withholding the protection of law from a whole class of human beings in the way that the courts were intervening in the 50s and 60s, finally making way to the recognition that they could indeed challenge the laws in those southern states that were withholding the protection of the law from a whole class of black people. So there's nothing, just nothing arcane about this. There's no novelty. It's not like we haven't done anything like this before. Court is always making judgments about how closely can you be justified in searching somebody body cavities? Can that be justified? Looking into somebody's private driveway? The courts are always making decisions about this. Well, what is a justified extension of the law? There's nothing here that's really bizarre or arcane.
And so, when do you think this starts to change, in jurisprudence? Where is there a hinge moment? Is there a place we can point to where this shift really started to take hold?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. With the dissenters in Roe versus Wade, with Justice Rehnquist and Justice White. The lawyers had presented a powerful case drawing on the findings of embryology. Nothing in that rich brief was put in place by those dissenters. And it's been not put in place by the majority in Dobbs now. What do? They retreated the notion that the real wrong here was a wrong done by judges. They've overstepped their lane. That abortion is not contained in the Constitution, and therefore a federal judge doesn't have the authority to proclaim anything about rights of abortion arising from the text of the Constitution. So, but of course, the Constitution said nothing about marriage when the court struck down the laws that barred interracial marriage in 1967. And as my friend Jerry Bradley pointed out, the federal government had always had ample reason to be dealing with the business of abortion, to dealing with abortion in medical hospitals, in federal hospitals, in military hospitals, in diplomatic outposts abroad, in the territories, in the District of Columbia. There's nothing about this subject that moved it outside the reach of a lawmaking power where the Congress did have the authority and the responsibility to make laws. So what happened at that moment was that Byron White, Justice White, said, well, this is really could be appalling. He's saying that people could order up an abortion simply when it suits their convenience. But then he turned and he transmuted the subject. And he shifted the victim from the child in the womb being killed. The victim was now the people in the states who are deprived of their freedom to deliberate in the political arena about their laws on abortion. So as it went forward, we found then people in the conservative movement said, that was the real wrong of abortion. We should not be addressing these moral questions. And so it became an article of faith, curiously, among conservatives that these moral judgments are not part of the law. The problem here is that judges really reached beyond themselves in reaching to these moral conclusions. Those moral conclusions should be only in the political arena, and making those moral judgments should never be the work of judges. And of course, inescapably, it is the work of judges. As I used to say to to ask whether the judge can get to the day without natural laws, ask him whether he can get to the day without moral reasoning on matters of right and wrong. And you might as well ask the question, it's like asking, can I order the coffee without using syntax? You know, it's not out there. It's woven into everything you do. But the curious thing, people go so reactive. Look, I began going to pro-life marches since 1974, the first time I ever helped. People out there, young and old, were concerned about babies being dismembered or poisoned. I saw no signs about the real wrong of judges overstepping their bounds. That was not the wrong. And so what we had here is people like my dear friend Annie Coulter saying, what's the argument about? The issue was that there's no constitutional right to an abortion. The court settled that one. So what are we arguing about now? That's all. The wrong of the case was reduced to the fact that judges reached the problem. Instead of saying that the wrong of the fact was that the judges created a license, a virtually unrestricted license, to take innocent life in the womb for virtually any reason. Not only throughout the length of pregnancy, but as we discovered, even when the child came out and survived the abortion.
The Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski. Every day, Chris helps unpack the connection between politics and the economy and how it affects your wallet. Will Republicans miss another layup? New polls show 40% of Republicans don't want Trump to run, but he's still leading in the polls. Has the new Republican strategy become leaning to the left on certain issues? How should Republicans approach this primary strategy with an easy path to the White House? Whether it's happening in D.C. or down on Wall Street, it's affecting you financially. Be informed. Check out the Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a chapter in the book entirely on Aquinas and that other first principle of moral judgment. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
It's the one that Aquinas said, that the good is that which we desire, the good is that which we approve, and the bad are those things we should refrain from doing and we should discourage from doing. And John Courtney Murray thought that's so evident. It's almost like something we know a priori. You know, the Red Sox come home from winning the World Series. People are cheering and applauding. They're not throwing stones. You know, there's a natural reaction to approving what you think is good and disapproving what you think, punishing what you think is wrong. Okay, that's right. But of course, cast in those terms, the same thing would apply to the mafia. The mafia has a clear sign of what makes a good citizen within the mafia. He doesn't rat on other people. And that's why we need the witness protection program, because those are the wrongdoers, the people who would rat on their friends. But it's a critical point that keeps getting in on us, because people don't quite understand that. I use the example of my friend Dan Robinson in a famous hearing on fetal pain in 1985 in the Judiciary Committee. And this Dr. Berkowitz from Yale complained about Dr. Nathanson, who had been a leader in the abortion rights movement, who then flipped and became leader in the pro-life movement. He said, well, Dr. Nathanson is not disinterested or neutral on this question. And Orrin Hatch says, but Dr. Berkowitz, I have no opinion. I have no opinion. And Hatch says, but doctor, you perform them. You perform them. If you understand, and then Dan Robinson's point, I said, what's this waltz about? If you thought something was wrong, that logic of the first principle comes into play. You should not do what is wrong. You're obliged to do what is right and refrain from what is wrong. So, Dr. Berkowitz, if you're performing those abortions, we gather you must think there's nothing wrong about it. In which case, why are you so diffident about reporting the number of times you've done it? And if you think it is wrong, why are you standing here defending it? In other words, I try to show in the book, that was the key point that Lincoln used in his classic debate with Douglas just to to destroy Douglass's argument there, that it is so basic and it's serviceable. And suddenly you see it at play in that those hearings on fetal pain, where Robinson just refuted Dr. Berkowitz. He's saying suddenly that first principle, always there, suddenly comes in, it kicks on in us with an effect that we hadn't anticipated. But it's always been there. But my point has been that that principle could be used on for the mafia as well as other people, that you have to get the closer first principle, the one that Kant as well as Thomas Reed considered as the real first principle of all moral and legal judgment, is that it makes absolutely no sense to cast judgments of praise or blame on people for things they were powerless to do. So that we hold as the first principle that we don't hold people blameworthy or responsible for acts they were powerless to effect. That becomes one of those deep principles in our law. And I think it has something to do finally with what the deep wrong in principle is of racial discrimination. But anyway, my point, Emily, is that is a principle from which many other substantive things come. You say, okay, you begin with an understanding of what the law may reach, that you don't hold people blameworthy, that when we're faced with John Stuart Mill says, we stop using the language of like and dislike, and start using the language of right and wrong, as we think people may rightly be punished for what they're doing. But if we respect that difference between innocence and guilt, that obliges us to take it seriously by using the most demanding canons of reason and testing evidence, rather than having people run over hot coals or outrun a mob in the street. And as you take the thing, bring it out further, just draw out the implication that arise that first principle, Emily. You arrive at a judgment of this kind, that people accused of crimes should have access to those, the witnesses and evidence arrayed against them, so they have a chance to rebut them. And rebutting them, arriving at a verdict that is more substantively accurate in discriminating between innocence and guilt. So if you, that logic, as I argue, but that moral logic, we would of course have the right to confront witnesses against us. We'd have that right, but even if it weren't set down in the Sixth Amendment. But my point is, you begin with something like, you may not be held responsible for acts you were powerless to effect. And from that, you could draw out moral judgments of real practical force and significance.
Mm. And actually, that's a great transition to the next chapter in which you write about natural rights. And Christopher Caldwell, in his excellent book, Age of Entitlement, talks a lot about rights and the expansion of our definition of rights, and how this question of human rights became a really slippery slope into basically all of the problems that we see with, what folks call wokeness right now and the capturing of all of our institutions. But I wanted to ask you, because you're writing about natural rights here, if you were explaining to, for instance, a student, what the distinction is between natural rights and human rights, if any, or if perhaps those should all be the same umbrella definition, most people are very familiar with the shorthand human rights. Whether they know what that actually means and feel confident in its grounding in philosophy is a different question. So can you talk a little bit about that distinction, if you think there is one?
Well, this example might help, Emily. That example I use of the visitor who comes from London and lands in New York. And we don't think we have to look at his passport before we protect him from a lawless assault on the street. We don't think that his claim to that protection depends on his citizenship. But the same man can't take himself over to the City College of New York and expect to be enrolled at that subsidized rate of tuition that people in New York make available to citizens. That is, certain rights arise only in certain enclaves, like the right to use the squash courts at Amherst College. Now, then the question is, if you're saying that this man has a right not to be assaulted, does not depend on his citizenship, what are you saying? What do you call it? Is some kind of a right that flows to any human being by nature. Now, we know the natural right to life does not mean a right to life everlasting, or that you could not be put in harm's way by the government in defense of the country or subjected to capital punishment. What the right to life meant is that one has a right to be protected from a lawless, unjustified taking of a life. What theft is taxation can remove people's property. What theft is the taking of property without justification. You know, this is what the problem is with natural rights. What you can say is that human beings have a natural claim to be treated justly with justifications when their freedoms are being restricted. And ordinary people have a natural sense of these things. You know, I had a couple of years ago, people in my spiffy apartment building were put out on the grounds for 2 hours because the firefighters were fighting a fire in the building. No one, believe me, liked being out there for those 2 to 3 hours. Our liberty to run, go back to our apartments. And yet nobody thought that their rights were being violated. Why is that? Think of a common sense understanding. My liberty is being restricted, but with the purpose of protecting my life. That is to say, there's a justification for it. That is the natural understanding that always affected the question of rights. You may have a presumptive claim. In fact, this is one of the arguments that we had in an older argument about the Bill of Rights. We could say, we could add to the Bill of Rights my right to be, not have my trunk searched in the car, my right not, without good reason, my right not to have my luggage searched at the airport without good reason, my right not to have blood withdrawn from my arm after an accident to test whether I had been driving under the influence of alcohol. We could go on elaborating all these instances without getting to the heart of the problem, which whatever we're dealing with, whatever aspect of freedom we're dealing with, the question is that as a search, the search being conducted with or without justification? People are going into subways. In New York, there's a fear of a, that's interesting. People going into subways in New York, there's a fear of a bombing. And so the authorities are checking the bags of people going into the subway. Now, the interesting question is raised. Now, were there constitutional rights engaged here? Because, it could be the right not to be directly searched. No, it could also be that the deep constitutional right that the authorities in New York are representing, when they're acting to protect ordinary people from having their lives taken in an unjustified way with a bombing in the subways. It's not only the courts that protect natural rights. And so all these things will keep pivoting on the question of, look, at the time of the founding, everybody understood the difference between liberty and license. Liberty being directed to a rightful or innocent end, as being misused and directed to a wrongful end. So hovering over the question of liberty at all times was the question of, are you using this liberty to do innocent, unlawful things? Are you using it to do things that may be rightly restricted? Mm-hmm. Look, I saw you in Connecticut Avenue a couple of years ago. I ran into a young fellow with a bicycle, about to take the bicycle into the subway. And I said, gee, can you do that? He said, yes, but not during rush hour. And he understood that his liberty was being restricted, but there were really good reasons for doing it. And therefore, he didn't think his rights were being violated. Now, see, Emily, my point is that ordinary people make these decisions every day. There's nothing arcane about it. There's nothing inscrutable about these things. These are matters of common sense. People, they frame the problem in these, this natural inclination to frame the problem in with this moral frame.
So interesting. And I love the way that you put this. This is actually a chapter title. The Conservatives and the Lore of Defensive Relativism. I love the phrase defensive relativism, and I wanted to see if you could kind of, you talked about it a little bit earlier, actually, but if you could sort of tell us what you mean by that term and what you mean by it, sort of the lore that it's had over conservatives, that would be great.
Oh, yeah. It's like, we're afraid that people are going to be so restrict conservatives. The best thing you do is say there is no ground for detecting the difference between offensive and offensive and rightful speech. We see there is no ground for this. The Nazis parading in Skokie. No, there's no ground for saying there's something wrong about the Nazis parading in Skokie. Well, the problem is if there are no grounds of right and wrong, there's no ground on which to hold to the rightness of freedom of speech. And I remember years ago when I was when I was finding myself on the other side of the ACLU on the matter of the Nazis in Skokie, Dave Hamlin of the ACLU was saying, how did it go? We protect speech even when it's even when it's popular or offensive. But the honest is, the sense of was offensive means it's unpopular. Things you don't like, it's unpopular. What seemed to be ruled out, and that's what seemed to be what the court is saying these days when Justice Alito and Gorsuch, bedrock of our First Amendment is we protect speech even when it's offensive. Now, that seems to rule out the notion that offensive does not mean merely it's unpopular. But there's some speech that is indeed offensive, wrongful in point of principle. It's the riling up hatred toward racial religious minorities, the libels, the attacks on people's reputations, stirring up hatred for people. What the founders understood was that speech can be a vehicle for inflicting injury along with every other medium of our freedom. And when they saw it, then the question was, well, are you committing a libel? Or John Marshall's line, you could be, you're stirring up hatred, stirring up a mob against religious minorities. They can understand when speech is being used to inflict harms. And at times it doesn't even need to be a material harm. There's a case years ago in Maryland where a black family had moved in. Someone had burned a cross outside the home of the family. By the time the family got home, the cross was already cleaned up. They were not affected by it. But people in the community had a sense that something wrong had been done. This kind of an expressive attack. So it's like Stan Evans's old line. The problem with pragmatism is that it doesn't work. You're trying to, we're getting this problem. We don't want to give people the authority to make these hard decisions, to talk about the speech that is legitimate or illegitimate. And the problem there's been no safety in that. That kind of stance of relativism has not protected conservatives on the campuses, made it easier for conservative speakers to go to the law school at Stanford. None of that has given us any. The classic doctrine here was, with the Chaplinsky case, the old classic case, that we can tell the difference between arguments and assaults. We had the famous case of it was giving at a PTA meeting, getting up at a PTA meeting. And he had every other word was the adjective mother effing. And the point is, by asking him to refrain from using that word and destroying the climate of civility, you're not barring him from giving the most searing critique of the school board. This was Justice Murphy's opinion in the old Chaplinsky case. It's the kind of speech that is not necessary to the exposition of any ideas. You can bar people from calling names and stirring violence and stirring people to conflict, or just doing coughing the names that insult and denigrate. You can do that without barring their freedom to make the most substantive arguments. And the accent, my argument is that this thing should be is, no, we can tell the language and the gesture, the burning of crosses, the language that is understood as language of denigration, and so we know them, the N-word. And I hate to say it, ordinary people understand these things. Truck drivers understand. You don't need lawyers to understand what kinds of words and gestures are taken as denigrating terms. And it's easy to spot. In fact, we work with the convention that restricted when it's evident to everybody in ordinary language. This is one of those terms to meant to assault and denigrate. If in doubt, do not do anything, right? But we can work in that scheme, and that at the meantime say, we are free. You can avoid those kinds of assaults, but free to make even the most strong. We can bar the Nazis from marching through the streets with banners and swastikas in Skokie, Illinois, and a community containing people who survived the Holocaust. We can do that while at the same time allowing Mein Kampf to be published. It's a different kind of thing. There's an argument. Mm. And my point is that the conservatives are making a profound mistake when they think that you can deal with the repression of conservatives by simply planting the point that we have no grounds of principle at all for making any distinctions between speech that is assaulting and speech that is innocent, cast in the form of arguments.
And, you know, this question of, as you put it, the defense of relativism makes me think of, I'm actually really curious as to what response you've gotten so far. I mean, the book's been out for about a day. You've been talking to a lot of folks, obviously, you know, for a long time about these issues that you articulate here. The conservative legal movement is pretty tightly knit and pretty robust. And I guess I just wonder what the response is, because I imagine there's a note of defensiveness in some of those conversations. Can you tell us just a little bit about that experience?
About the what?
About your experience, you know, making these arguments to folks in the conservative legal movement who are probably very defensive of some of the defensive relativism, for instance.
It's curious, but I have to say, when people hear it, they think, yeah, I think you've got a point.
Agree.
I know, it's amazing. I had this debate on natural law with Alexander Kaczynski in 2012. I was making my point. Some friends going around the audience, hearing people say, I believe that. I believe that. Mm. Once they hear it, they suddenly it may jibe with common sense, and they recognize that they've always known it. The problem is people get locked in. You know, we always say that the conservatives complained again for years that these liberal judges were using this moral reasoning, going outside the text and creating these creating rights built upon the agenda of the left. We'll show them. We won't use moral reasoning, and we'll shame them. Great device. Great strategic move. It said, we will show. It never barred the Steve Reinhardts of the world from going on with what they were doing. And I mind this, if you think there's something wrong with what these people are doing while they're affecting moral postures, well, the answer is show them where they're wrong. Show them where it's specious, you know. But, you know, people do get locked in, and people will say, look, you may be right, but look, we've got to, it's a credential that we've got to deal with this thing. And the best thing we could do is tell people they have no grounds for making these judgments. And so you have, say, Kyle Duncan going over to the law school at Stanford. You tell me, you walk through a hall on the way to the meeting, and you have people out spitting out contempt for you and insults. And you say, that's a welcome? That's a welcome to the, that's a support for your freedom to speak? That's an assault. It's clearly a sign of hostility meant to intimidate you and to show that you have no standing to even to give the speech. Why do you assume it's legitimate as long as people are not picking up stones. Now, we ordinary people are able to tell the difference between no words that acts that are denigrating and dismissive. People know when they're being treated casually. And as I say, this is something of truck drivers can do this as well as lawyers. They know when they're being disrespected. They know when an ethnic term is used to disparage them. This understanding is contained in ordinary language and this moral sense that people naturally have. Human beings are moral creatures. They're given to argue over things that are right or wrong and make judgments. And of course, the words at work, there are words that work in our language that are meant to convey that judgment. So I don't know what words I can say. There's that classic case of Cohn versus California with a guy in the courthouse in Los Angeles with, I don't know if we can say this, so I'll say he said the word on his back was F the draft.
Right. Okay.
How do I speak? F asterisk asterisk the draft. Okay. And Justice Harlan was saying, what does he have? He was, all words are emotive. We don't know what he's saying. You can't pass a judgment. You don't know why this word is worse than anything else. Well, you know, all the words are made. So F the draft could have meant make love to the wind, you know? We know that's not what it meant. We know it's what it meant. After draft as a mark of, it was a condemnatory term. He was condemning the draft. How do we? Because that's the function that these moral terms have in the language. These are the words you use when you're denigrating, attacking, assaulting people. So there's nothing mysterious about that. We couldn't get along in our lives without knowing, having a sense of how those words are used. So the curious thing about conservatives, they have to dash away from all of this. You know, somebody reminded me of Mussolini writing a tract saying, the great thing about cultural relativism, it shows there's no ground of wrong in pursuing our policies. Great. In fact, that's why I think students fall into this, because it's the natural appeal of it is to say, if there are no grounds of moral judgment, there are no grounds for people to cast any judgments on me. You know, I call into question what I'm doing. But to adopt this as a principle governing around this, what is a religion? Can't make a just kind of what's offensive. So religion can include Satanism, the affirmation of radical evil. And so we have to be morally relative on all that stuff. You know, was the God of the Declaration of Independence, the one who the author of the laws of nature, including the moral law, could not have been indifferent on the question of affirming radical evil. There's nothing about that. Our understanding of religion makes no sense unless it contains the first principle or God. And if it does, we always understand that God is a God directed to upstanding, upright, rightful things, not a God who's teaching evil. I mentioned this to somebody the other day. Imagine Moses came down from Sinai and he told the Hebrews gathered around, the Lord our God told us, don't worry overly much about lying down with somebody else's wife, you know, and taking what is not yours. If he came down saying things like that, I think the people around him would have been scratching their heads and saying, are you sure you got that right? Are you listening?
Right. It's all very helpful. And it leads me to the question. I know you've been talking about this a lot and thinking about it a lot. There's just been a flurry of recent attacks on conservative justices on the court, from Justice Thomas to now Justice Gorsuch. Sure. The New York Times has published an investigation of the Antonin Scalia Law School over at George Mason University.
Oh, really? Really?
Oh, yeah. It's a long one.
Of course. Look, if Clarence Thomas had books overdue at the library, it would be a major issue for Senator Whitehouse. And no, it's obviously contrived. Right. It's simply a campaign of denigration and smearing. And so it's curious that I know some, one of my sons was telling me, oh, this is about Clarence Thomas. People pick this up and they're open to it. And then they start taking it seriously. They don't know that liberal judges have been given the same terms for the freedom to accept gifts from, like, Justice Brennan, I gather, was given a gift by and this who's that fellow in charge of the Gillers at NYU does specialize in lawyerly ethics, saying, well, it's not a problem, you know, it's his friend, and it wasn't before the court. When it comes to Clarence Thomas, he said, oh, no, this is a serious matter. We can't presume in favor of Justice Thomas. The whole thing is politically tilted, motivated, animated by a wrongful purpose. It's and I'm afraid it accords with this current thing that's new, really novel in my life, and it's the scariest part of this willingness to carry out attacks in private houses, outside the homes of judges, to attack people in restaurants. It's and just keep dunning on me, make charges, even though they may not be true, and a campaign of denigration. And if it's sounded or not long, it'll be accepted or believed, or even if not believed, accepted as the party line of the day. And so we hold to it. And what it all involves again is this remarkable detachment from truth, that people no longer are embarrassed to do something that just cannot be tested with any claims of truth. The inconsistencies and treatment of the conservative and liberal justice, no longer embarrass. You know, I don't know much about Carl Schmitt. Many of my friends have been much into that, how Carl Schmitt, this Nazi writer, who was a thoughtful man, was even taken seriously by my former professor, Leo Strauss, my late professor. But here's Carl Schmitt, taught a very clear doctrine of friends and enemies. That becomes the decisive point. So if you're Merrick Garland, you've been given the people around you, guiding you, it's clear that whatever you say, Alito, Barrett, Kavanaugh, Thomas, they're the enemies. No, you don't overdo it in protecting them. You don't overdo it. They're the enemies. They're open. And this is what's so novel to me about what's settled in over the last several years. That's the scariest, the scariest phase I've ever remembered in my own life is what our politics has looked like.
Well, is there anything else we haven't touched on from the book you think is important for listeners to take away?
Just maybe reiterate a certain kind of theme that the founders began, we ordinary people, well, you know that old line about from Jefferson, yeah, you saw me quoted, but you can give the same moral problem to a professor and a plowman, and the plowman is apt to get it right, because he is not deflected by artificial rules or theories. I mean, conservative judges have to talk themselves into a theory of why the judges could not reason about this matter of abortion, whether the evidence was compelling enough to point out that these were human beings destroying these things. We have ample grounds for declaring that those, holding that those laws in Texas and other places were justified. I want to just go back to the point that the American founders did not draw their moral understanding or their legal understanding from the Constitution. That was not the source of their understanding. They began with those principles outside that were there in the first place. Those principles, right and wrong, were there. Often matters of common sense reasoning, like you don't hold people blameworthy for acts they were powerless to effect. And that carried them into the Constitution. And those things are still there. They realized they would be there. Those principles there, even if they were not mentioned in the Constitution. That's what my point about John Quincy Adams and the right to petition the government. of course, at the same time, what they're doing is they're creating a structure. People say, well, if there are these principles outside the text, are you saying you don't need the Constitution? Yes, I do need the Constitution. I need a structure. I need to know whether a state may make its territory available as a naval and military base for a foreign power. I want to know whom the army would be expected to obey when the president dies in office. Those are structural matters. Obamacare was given a real bump in the road when, in 2010, the Constitution, for the 56th time in War and Peace, served up a midterm election. Nobody noticed, because these are parts of the Constitution that we're not litigating over. Okay, we need those things. The task of the Constitution is to begin with those anchoring first principles. As Lincoln said, you know, the nation began, as Lincoln said, not with the drafting of the Constitution, but with the Declaration of Independence. It gave us the first principle that any rightful governance over human beings must be depend on the consent of the governed. And then we have to figure out what is the kind of constitution that can give us a pattern of practice that's consistent with that principle. So again, that question arises, what is the difference between the positive law of America and the positive law of Stalin's Russia? It has something to do with the fact that people were authorized to make positive law binding on us because of this primary principle that we have to contrive an arrangement consistent with the consent of the governed. And it's just necessary to sort of recall those old things. And so often, Emily, it's a matter of just recalling for a new generation, or even some people around us now, recalling the things as a people that we once used to know.
The book is called Mere Natural Law, Originalism and the Anchoring Truths of the Constitution. Hadley Arkus, thank you so much for joining us here in Federalist Radio Hour.
Oh, Emily, you read that book, and you were so dear to and thanks for this fine interview.
Oh, of course. Anytime is a fascinating book, and I'm excited for folks to check it out. It was released on May 2nd, so it is available now. Go out and get your copy. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I heard the faint voice of reason.